You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of November, 2013, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Ty Genwright.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's news agenda with Xenia Dormandy from Chatham House. What have you got for us, Xenia?
We've got three stories this morning. The first is the American B-52 bombers going over the Senkakus in response to China's threats earlier this week. The second is a sad story. It's almost a year now after the Newton massacres in the United States. Why is it that America's not been able to get anything done on gun control? And then, of course, you can't avoid the Iran nuclear deal.
More from Xenia in a little bit. Also on the program, could today finally be the end of Silvio Berlusconi's long and scandal-ridden political career? Or does he still have a few tricks up his sleeve?
And then we're off to Copenhagen for the Creative Business Cup.
We plan to bring a kind of a revolution in pediatrics in a way that we provide data that is not influenced by the level of stress children go to once they realize they need to go to the doctor's office.
Plus, we'll be in Istanbul to find out how Turkey is slowly losing influence and friends in the region.
Also, we'll be asking if drones could become a useful tool for news reporters.
They have started to offer a unique perspective on scenarios and situations where it might be difficult or dangerous indeed for a journalist to venture into a particular area.
All that, plus we'll review the Nordic front pages with our in-house Finn, Marcus Hippie. And we'll also play some music, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So a very busy 60 minutes coming up ahead for this edition of Midori House. But before we get started, here's David Spencer with the news headlines.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. Japan says its airlines will not recognize China's new air defense zone over disputed islands in the East China Sea. Beijing published coordinates for the defense zone over the weekend and warned it would take defensive emergency measures against aircraft that failed to identify themselves properly in the airspace. Airlines in Japan had been submitting flight plans to China since that announcement, but the government in Tokyo says it will guarantee their aircraft safe passage across the area. Japan and the United States have sharply criticized the restricted airspace, and the US ambassador to Japan, Caroline Kennedy, has praised Tokyo for its restraint.
As Secretary Kerry said last weekend, we hope to see a more collaborative and less confrontational future in the Pacific. Unilateral actions like those taken by China with their announcement of an East China Sea air defense identification zone undermine security and constitute an attempt to change the status quo in the East China Sea. This only serves to increase tensions in the region.
Germany's two biggest political parties have made a breakthrough in talks to form a new government. Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats have been in talks about forming a grand coalition for several weeks. If approved, the agreement would enable Merkel to form a government by Christmas. Several policies around taxation and spending have been agreed, while another sees a move to impose higher road tolls on foreign drivers. The US Coast Guard says 30 Haitian migrants have died and 110 have been rescued after their boat capsized in the Bahamas. A rescue operation has been taking place over the last 24 hours after the vessel ran aground and capsized on Monday night. Anti-government protesters in Thailand have marched out of Bangkok as they bid to shut down 14 government ministries. They forced the evacuation of Thailand's top crime-fighting agency on the fourth day of street demonstrations. They accused the government of being controlled by the Prime Minister's brother, Thaksin Shinawatra. The anti-Thaksin movements are being led by former MP Suthep Thaksaban, for whom police have issued an arrest warrant. Silvio Berlusconi faces one of the heaviest blows of his 20-year political career later today when the Italian Senate votes on stripping him of his seat in Parliament over a conviction for tax fraud. The vote will be the culmination of months of political wrangling and is almost certain to lead to his expulsion from the upper house. The centre-right leader has already pulled his party out of Prime Minister Enrico Letta's ruling coalition after 7 months in government accusing left-wing opponents of conspiring against him. US President Barack Obama has ended his West Coast tour with a stop in Glendale in California to visit the DreamWorks studio. Obama highlighted the role of the entertainment industry and in its played in creating jobs and boosting sluggish economy. Calling the entertainment industry one of the bright spots in the US economy, Obama said the United States remained the best place to make movies and music.
Entertainment is one of America's biggest exports. And every day you sell a product that's made in America to the rest of the world. Every time somebody buys movie tickets or DVDs or distribution rights to a film, some of that money goes back to the local economy right here.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
David Spencer, thank you for that. I have to say, I've seen plenty of Hollywood movies.
I think they're doing pretty well.
Yeah, but I've seen plenty that would make me question as to whether or not they are the best producers of movies in the world. you know those kind of Christmassy family movies, and I put a family
like
in
Elf.
Inverted commas, that just make you wonder, why? Why bother? What contribution has this made to mankind?
They fork out $20 to go watch those.
Silly
films.
People. Silly, silly people. 6 minutes past the hour, 6 minutes past eight here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. Time now to set the day's news agenda with the stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. And joining us in the studio is Xenia Dormady, Project Director for the US program at Chatham House here in London. Lovely to see you, Xenia.
Always a pleasure.
Where should we begin this morning?
Let's start on the Newton story and get the worst over and done with. Most people will remember in mid-December of last year, there was yet another awful massacre in a school, Sandy Hook Elementary School in the United States in Newton, Connecticut. I think it was 22 children killed, a number of adults as well. And the question really, people are coming a year later to take a look at that and say, why is it that America has been so unable to get gun control through any changes? And partly it's political. Partly it's, you know, it rests on the American Constitution and this sense that the right to bear guns is something that was put in the Constitution and can't be taken out and shouldn't be taken out. But there's a real, it's a really important marker, I think, for what's going on in American politics today.
But is it so much political as cultural? Is it now embedded within a large part of the American culture that they want to have guns at the ready?
You're absolutely right. It is embedded in culture. But what was interesting after the massacre is so many people said this doesn't make sense. And there was a huge public upswell that President Obama, Vice President Biden kind of took a hold of. And this was one of those issues that was kind of handed over to Biden and said, do something with this. And of course, you know, a month later, people had forgotten and nobody wanted to get anything done. The volume of the minority is so great that they couldn't move the ball forward. But I do think it's indicative in part of this idea that at the moment, there is no way for that. There are a few domestic wins for President Obama. And in large part, that's because the Republicans do not want to give him a domestic win.
And it is one issue trying to take guns away from Americans, which is something I don't think the Obama administration is trying to do. But, you know, a recent poll, 9 out of 10 Americans, so a vast majority of Americans agree at least to some more extensive background checks, the most simplest of things that you would think would be able to get passed.
And
that's not getting passed. And of course, you mentioned Vice President Joe Biden there, who was tasked with really leading reform of the gun industry and gun laws in America. But I don't really see where he's been in all of this.
Well, exactly. So the other part of the story that I think is interesting and worth emphasizing is because they haven't been able to get anything done through the legislative branch, what President Obama done is use executive order. I think he's imposed 22 or 23 executive orders on gun control since Sandy Hook, the Sandy Hook massacre. That's this administration's response to a lack of progress in the political system. Now, to me, that's a very, very dangerous move. You saw last week, for the first time, I think 250 years, that in order to confirm an individual in the political system at a senior level, this is, you have to get 60 votes in Congress. It's now 50. That's kind of filibuster proof is what they're calling it in the United States. Again, this is an attempt to say we've got to find ways around this dysfunction, this political dysfunction, executive order. That's another one. These to me are very, very worrying signs, because even if you agree with President Obama, what happens when the tables get turned?
But if there is consensus, and I mentioned that poll again, the Washington Post poll, which has 9 out of 10 Americans favor more extensive background checks, why aren't their elected officials doing what the people want?
It's a very good question, because, and this happens in the UK too, this is the volume of the minority overweighs the size of the majority. The majority tends to be quiet. They don't vote. They don't come out. The minority does. And in America, the rifle-wielding minority wins.
Another aspect of the Adam Lanza story, and it's not to absolve the role of guns in it, but that this was a deeply, deeply disturbed young man. And I just wonder what your assessment is of the state services that should be there to ensure people like this are protected from themselves and that we're protected from them too.
I think that's a great point, because it brings into yet another story that's going round and round the United States press at the moment, which is the healthcare. You know, does America have the right system to protect Americans from themselves and from others when it's needed? Do they have the right system to provide the basic healthcare? And the answer is there aren't the resources that there once were. Why is it that people with real psychological problems are out on the streets? It's because there isn't the funding to look after them in the way that perhaps one would like to look after them. And there are real repercussions of this.
Zennia, let's move on to Iran, a story that many people...
A more positive story.
People in the West may be positive about the deal, but not many countries in the Middle East and the Gulf region.
Exactly. I think one of the most interesting things, we've been so focused on the P5+1 negotiations with Iran, the fact that we've come through these negotiations. We have at least a six-month deal that will allow longer negotiations to take place. But we appear to be losing sight sometimes of what the repercussions are for the rest of the region. The Israelis are extremely worried about this deal and the fact that it could open the door to Iran getting that much closer to a nuclear weapon. And there are some who say that Israel will in the next 6 months have to attack Iran as a result and knock out some of their nuclear weapons facilities, or nuclear facilities, I should say. But also other countries like Saudi Arabia, that has long felt itself to be really the regional hegemon, if you will, the regional power base, and perhaps even more than that, sees Iran coming back. Iran taking a stronger position as they once did have, sees Iran potentially usurping their close relationship with the United States. And you've really seen the Saudis, as I put it, actually, I think on Monocle a few weeks ago, you know, throw the toys out of the pram with the United States, say they weren't going to take their seat on the UN Security Council. The Turks watching this very, very close. Some of the other Gulf countries watching this very, very closely. All very nervous that Iran is being rehabilitated, as it were.
Well, they are essentially selfish fears by Turkey, by Saudi, by Israel. Are they rational fears?
It's a very good question.
Are they fears that we should be fearful of?
Well, I was going to say, I'm not sure that you can say selfish and rational are opposites. They're selfish fears, absolutely, but we're all selfish in foreign policy and domestic policy, for that matter. We all want what is going to meet our best interests. Should we be worried about this? Yes, insofar that it brings instability to the region. If what you're doing is you're essentially saying, and I'm going to simplify this vastly, you're saying that Saudi Arabia was the kind of the regional power base in the Middle East, and now actually you've got a Saudi-Iranian balance. That isn't necessarily a terribly stable balance. Now, again, that's vastly simplified, but should we be worried about that? Yeah, I think we have to be nervous towards it. And perhaps most importantly, we have to recognize it and respond to it.
Well, I'm wondering, are we starting to see the emergence of perhaps a bit of a strange alliance? And when I say strange alliance, I'm talking about Israel with Saudi Arabia, with other Gulf kingdoms, which they not necessarily have gotten along with in the past.
You might do. I think what you're seeing is a lot of people. I mean, and again, let's just take Israel to start with. You're seeing Israel kind of stick its head up and say, the whole world around us is changing. You know, Egypt is fundamentally in a different place than it was 3 years ago. To a lesser extent, or at least less important to Israel, Tunisia also. There are changes taking place in Morocco and in Jordan. And what are the implications of that? We haven't even talked about Syria. And so they are absolutely looking around and saying, where can we find our new friends and allies? Historically, it was Egypt that they had an alliance with. They still have one with Egypt and with Jordan, but they're a little bit less confident about those. And so maybe Saudi Arabia is the partner with whom we should be engaging a little bit more closely. But again, what you have to recognize with all of this fluctuations in the region is don't miss out that just because we're focused on what we think is a very positive development with Iran, that there aren't some in the region that actually look at this very, very nervously, and the fact that Iran might return to its kind of strong position.
And from the Middle East to the Far East, you're taking us next, Zenya.
Yes, indeed. And I think this story was the one about China, as you read in the news update just on the hour, had earlier this weekend, in fact, announced that no flyovers, the Senkakus, the Diaoyu, I can't pronounce that, islands.
Rather you than me.
Exactly. Well, we'll stick to Senkakus for the benefit of this. Because of security, because of defense, if you were going to fly over those islands, you had to let the Chinese know. This is a fundamental change to where the status quo was, which was that certainly Japan has controlled those islands for many decades now. You had to let the Japanese know, but the Chinese have claimed them for many years now. Of course, the American response to that just yesterday was to fly two B-52 bombers over them and not alert the Chinese.
How is this going to actually work in practice? Because it's not just military aircraft that need to gain permission. Qantas, Singapore Airlines
Absolutely.
Have said that they would alert Chinese officials. But the Americans and Japanese airlines said they wouldn't be. So are we going to be seeing scrambling of jets, escorting these planes in that airspace? How is it going to all work?
This is a symptom of the ongoing tensions between Japan and China. And both sides, to some extent, really trying to get a leg up and change the status quo in the case of the Chinese. How this will play out, the hope, I think, is that you will see, following the B-52 bombers, you will see perhaps similar responses from a number of other countries to say, essentially, no, we're not changing the status quo. And this will die down again. But we really do have to see what China does in response. You have to recognize also, of course, that this is the first year of President Xi. And so he's still testing his space. He's still trying to assert himself internationally and domestically. And so we're a little unsure of what the Chinese response is going to be. But we do need to make sure that, A, the status quo is maintained, and this is what the B-52s were about, but also that that tensions don't rise beyond a certain level.
Okay. Zenya Dormandy, Project Director for the United States at Chatham House. Thanks for coming in to talk to us.
Pleasure.
Coming up after this very short break, we'll be asking, could this week be finally the last stand for Silvio Berlusconi?
Stand back from your letterboxes and tone up your biceps, because the biggest ever issue of Monocle is about to hit subscribers' doormats and newsstand shelves. The December-January issue helps you bid farewell to 2013 and look over the horizon to 2014 with our soft power survey, the Monocle 100, and our travel top 50.
In the affairs section, we sit down for a series of interviews with global heavy hitters, from the President of Chile to the Australian Foreign Minister. We take a look at the Mexican President's to-do list, look at Japan's agenda for 2014, and ask 10 writers, academics, and economists to give us their predictions for the year to come.
In the business section, we visit three model factories that are working inspirations for their industries. From a shoelace factory in Hanover built by the early modernist Walter Gropius, to a restored Renaissance village in Umbria making knitwear, and a Japanese brand that's so transparent, its customers are invited to pitch their tents on the lawn outside. These are companies who've created beautiful, light-filled environments for their production lines and are reaping the benefits as a result.
The Monocle December January double issue is on newsstands now.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 9:20 in Rome. It is 8:20 here in London. Now, today, Italy's most notorious politician and everyone's favorite guy, Silvio Berlusconi, faces a vote by senators that will decide his political future. The man who added bunga bunga parties to the world's political consciousness faces expulsion from parliament because of the small matter of his conviction for tax fraud in his big media empire.
Well, he sought a presidential pardon, but yesterday was refused. Now the message from the man who thinks he was born to rule is that expulsion would amount to a coup d'etat. Il problema, though, for Berlusconi is that even his old allies are no longer listening to him. Well, Ivan Carvalho, Monocle's man in Milan, is on the line with us. So too is John Foote, the chair of Italian studies at Bristol University, both here to discuss my favourite character in world politics. Let me come to you first, John. Welcome to the show, first of all.
Hello, good morning.
I imagine Silvio Berlusconi is a man who you have followed for an awful long time. Is this the end?
Probably. I think is what we can say. I think for quite a long time there's been an end game going on ever since he lost elections in Milan, his hometown, some time ago. He's been losing votes, losing power. He's been convicted definitively. And I think being kicked out of Parliament would be another step on the road. But he's not going quietly, and he's still going to have 20-25% of the vote, at least. So it's not the final end, but it's one of the steps down the road towards the end of his political career.
And Ivan Carvalho, who is in Italy at the moment, Silvio Berlusconi calling on many of his supporters to turn out onto the streets of Rome today to protest this vote. What's the mood like there across the country? Are people fed up with Berlusconi and are eager to see him on the way out? Or do you think John's right that he still does have quite a few supporters?
With Berlusconi, this end game is really it's the endless end game. It'll be interesting to see today how many people do come out into the streets in Rome to abide by this call to his base to protest against his what looks like his obvious expulsion today from the Senate. And funnily enough, Alfano, who broke off from Berlusconi to form a new center-right party, will still actually vote in to not vote for the expulsion, but that's about all he's going to get today in terms of support, because it looks like the majority of the country, I think, is almost ready to turn the page. But again, with Berlusconi, it's very difficult to say this is the end, because 2 years ago, everyone was thinking that was the end when he resigned and Mario Monti came in. So we have to be a bit careful with Berlusconi.
Coming back to John Foote of Bristol University, quite interesting, isn't it, that all this comes 20 years after the launch of Forza Italia?
Yes, and then it's just relaunched Forza Italia, which had, in the meantime, changed its name and become something else. Yes, I mean, many historians and people are already calling this period the Berlusconi era, although he's still around, and calling it a kind of historical phase. 20 years ago, he launched this party. It was all very fresh. It was all new. He won an election 2 months after entering politics. It was all quite extraordinary, and one of the most extraordinary things ever happened, probably, in political life anywhere. Now it all seems very tired. I think most Italians, three-quarters of Italians, are fed up with this way of running things. And I think it is definitely time to turn the page. This horrible conflict of interest in private and public, which has paralyzed Italy for so long, really does have to finish. But he still wields massive influence. Whenever he says anything, it's reported everywhere on the press. He still has that media power. And I think that will mean that his influence will carry on even after he's outside of Parliament.
And John, do you think this will usher in a new era for stability, political stability in Italy when it comes to Prime Minister Enrico Letta?
Not really. I think Letta is actually less stable because Berlusconi's left the government and he's kind of the rump that split off for him are supporting Letta. But there, you know, who knows where their loyalties really lie. So it's not a stable situation. And I think it's quite likely that we will go to elections in the not-too-distant future. The real question is what happens at those elections and how many votes Berlusconi gets. But the immediate short term is actually less stable than before.
Coming back to Ivan in Milan, I mean, the other side story to all this, a very important story, is that the Italian economy is a mess. Looking at Berlusconi's legacy, how much of the blame do you think should be or is apportioned to him?
Well, you know, he was elected three times prime minister, and he has governed for quite many years during this period, and so one could lay a good deal of the blame at his doorstep for not bringing the economy up into, you know, modernizing the Italian economy, playing populist politics to win votes, for example, with the Alitalia sale, which was supposed to go through to Air France, and he was pulling together a nationalist collection of business people to bring it back into Italian hands. There's all kinds of things that he could have done to modernize the Italian economy, break up some of the lobbies. He never did that, and then he's also all the time been playing up the card that there's this center-left-wing judiciary that's been after him with all these cases, and that played well for a fair bit of time, but it now looks like that's coming to an end, and so I think he's going to have to accept in the history books blame for not modernizing Italy's economy.
Excellent stuff, Ivan. Ivan Carvalho in Milan, and John Foote, chair of the Italian Studies Program at Bristol University, speaking to us there.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tig Enright, and Phil Hahn. Now, this week's edition of The Entrepreneurs is all about creativity. And to set the scene, Monocle's Danny Giacopelli jetted over to Copenhagen for the international finals of the Creative Business Cup.
We're going to be hearing from various startups with products ranging from coffee to online learning and even gravestones. But to whet your appetite, let's hear from Team Croatia. This is 24-year-old Anna describing her creation, Teddy the Guardian.
It's literally a teddy bear, so it's a plush toy that has embedded medical sensors in his paws and at the back. So the point is that every time a child holds Teddy by the paw or hugs Teddy, sensors capture the data within 5 to 7 seconds. They structure it, analyze it, and send it wirelessly to the app that our team has created, where the data is visualized and managed. So the point is that over time we collect a lot of data from every child. Specifically, we plan to bring a kind of a revolution in pediatrics in a way that we provide accurate data, authentic data, data that is not influenced by the level of stress children go to once they realize they need to go to the doctor's office, or once they realize they need to go to the kindergarten, or once they are sick. So we want to achieve the emotionally neutral state with the children where we get the relevant data and not the one that is influenced by stress levels they go through. So this is our goal, our task, and this is Teddy's mission for the next few years, definitely.
Where did you get the idea from?
Well, we have had already one bootstrap startup, and that was kind of a software as a solution project. We did talk a lot to medical professionals. It was, again, a medical startup. What we did realize once we started going through clinics and hospitals is that nurses actually use plush toys in order to distract children from the fact they need to get their body temperature measured, which takes a lot of time, which makes nurses less efficient, and which does not make sense in a way that it should. So what we decided is to, okay, let's just save their time, save their money, and make children less stressed out, and let's just put sensors in a bear, and we'll see how it functions. So the idea caught up very quickly, and we got kind of a collaboration of offers from hospitals in the UK, US, Finland, for example, who really want to be the early adopters of that kind of a technology and that kind of a concept, which makes us really happy because we want to validate this product on the medical market and then extend it to the consumer market, but to make sure that this brand is trusted by medical professionals in order to be trusted by parents as well.
What's the Croatian startup scene like?
there is a sign of fast growth there. Up until now, 2 years ago or three maybe, we were not so familiar with the notion of a startup. A lot of students right now, and this is what we do as well, we're trying to be as active in at the university as possible to encourage students to do their own thing. Entrepreneurship is not for everybody, and this is the fact, we know that, but there's no better time to try and set up your own project than while you are at the faculty. There's no better internship than your own project, your own company. Even if it fails, even if you find it not your cup of tea, that's okay. Then you know you've tried, and you go and you get yourself employed somewhere. But there's been more and more startups developing there, young people trying to get their own work done, and not to get employed, but to employ themselves, which is brilliant. The situation is kind of hard in Croatia. The unemployment is huge. So this is always, as I say, I mean, there's no better time to start your own business than in time of crisis. And this has proven to be a good point. And I'm very excited to see Croatian scene grow even bigger in the next year.
And that was a preview of this week's Entrepreneurs Special on Creativity, which you can hear tonight at 1900 hours London time, 1400 hours in Toronto.
Coming up in the next half hour of the program, we'll be checking in with our man in Istanbul. We'll also find out about some journalistic drones.
They have started to offer a unique perspective on scenarios and situations where it might be difficult or dangerous indeed for a journalist to venture into a particular area.
But David Spencer is no drone. He's got the world news headlines.
Tig, thank you very much indeed, I think. Japan has told its airlines they do not have to recognise China's new air defence zone over disputed islands in the East China Sea. Carriers in Japan had been submitting flight plans to China since the weekend's announcement, but the government in Tokyo says it will guarantee their aircraft safe passage across the area. 2 months after Angela Merkel's election victory in Germany, there's been a breakthrough in talks to form a new government. The Chancellor's Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats have been in talks for several weeks. Around 4,000 anti-government protesters continue to occupy the Finance Ministry building in Bangkok. A group have marched out of the capital and say they bid to shut down 14 government ministries. The Italian Senate votes today on whether Silvio Berlusconi should be stripped of his seat in Parliament over a conviction for tax fraud. The centre-right leader has already pulled his party out of government, accusing left-wing opponents of conspiring against him. Hundreds of Egyptians opposed to a new protest law have continued their demonstrations in Cairo. The legislation passed on Sunday bans protests without police approval. A tiny book of Psalms has become the world's most expensive printed book after it sold at auction for $14.2 million. The copy of the Bay Psalm book from 1640 is one of only 11 still in existence and was the first ever book published in the United States. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
David, thank you. The time in Ankara is 10:32, it's 8:32 in London, and 3:32 in the wee small hours of the morning in New York City, the city that never sleeps. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tig Enright, and Phil Han.
It is time now to check in with one of our international correspondents around the world, and today, delighted to say we're joined by Joseph Dana, our Eastern Mediterranean correspondent, who is in Istanbul. Welcome to the programme, Joseph. Earlier on in the programme, we were talking about some shifting alliances in the Gulf and the Middle East. But there's some interesting fallout as well from Turkey and its partners in the region.
Absolutely. Turkey's been going through a kind of radical shift over the last couple of months in terms of its stated policy of not having any enemies in the neighborhood. And so we've seen that the Egyptian, the military-backed rulers in Egypt have forced out or expelled the Turkish ambassador, and that's created a quite serious fallout inside of Turkish domestic politics. Basically, the opposition parties against Prime Minister Erdogan's AK Party have been arguing that Turkey needs to kind of reevaluate what's going on in terms of its foreign policy, that if you look at the region, there's not a Turkish ambassador in Israel, there's not one in Syria, and now there's not one in Egypt. And so it looks like the opposition parties in this country are using this to really kind of get a foothold on Erdogan and try and make this into more of a domestic issue as well in terms of his leadership style.
Do the opposition parties in question have any creative suggestions for Mr. Erdogan in how he rebuilds diplomatic relations in the region?
If only that was the case. It seems as though they're looking at this in a very kind of, one would say almost a dirty kind of political way in which they can get a very strong shot into Erdogan's, Erdogan's rule. And they're also ignoring how Erdogan is opening up new relations with the Kurds in northern Iraq, as well as some of the Kurdish issues in Syria. And so, like I said, this is becoming one of those dirty political issues of the domestic realm, and it will be very interesting to see how Erdogan's government will react. I mean, he has now retaliated against the Egyptians by declaring the Egyptian ambassador, who is ironically out of the country at this moment, as a persona non grata. And so it looks like he's going to kind of step up some of his rhetoric towards Egypt. And if this continues, I think we're going to see it continue to become a major Turkish domestic issue as well.
It is quite fascinating, Joseph, watching this from the outside, because if you asked, you know, an onlooker at the start of this year, everyone was saying this was the year of Turkey. You know, there are great things to come for this country in the next few months, the next year. But of course, after the Gezi Park riots that happened, this kind of seemingly, everything seems to kind of be falling apart in Ankara. Is that the situation you're getting?
That's not necessarily the situation I'm getting. I think that is definitely a worry among many Turks, that their international image that they've worked so carefully to kind of curate over the last couple of years is falling by the wayside because of some of these domestic concerns. But there are people in Ankara that are looking at the situation in the Middle East regionally from a kind of long-durée perspective, and they're looking at creating kind of foundational energy partnerships, for one, between Israel and Turkey, between Iraqi Kurdistan and Turkey, that will fundamentally change Turkey's position in the international community. Now, it's not going to happen overnight, and these domestic concerns like Gezi Park will continue to provide some sort of unsavory headlines. But in the long term, this will create a situation in which Turkey does rise, and it will rise to a situation of international prominence.
Well, Joseph, leaving Turkish diplomatic or political influence to one side for a moment, now we're going to talk about construction influence, the Turkish construction industry spreading its concrete tentacles across the region. Do you like that, concrete
That's
tentacles?
Good.
Yeah.
Quite nice. But it is, again, another example of how Turkey is, you know, quite literally laying the foundations for regional and international prominence. A Turkish company, Anka, if I pronounce that correctly, along with an American company, have just laid the foundations for the biggest ever infrastructure project in Kosovo. Basically a massive, I mean, we're talking quite massive highway infrastructure project throughout the country that will create a very promising trade opportunity for Kosovo in terms of connecting it in the kind of the center of the Balkans. And so we see Turkish companies doing these infrastructure projects in the Balkans, and we see Turkish construction companies also working extensively in Africa. They come in behind China in terms of how many construction projects that they have in the African continent. And so again, we're seeing Turkey really lay the foundations of international prominence that in 5 years' time, in 3 years' time even, are going to be unavoidable when we look at Turkey's kind of position in the world.
And Joseph, let's move on to a very intriguing story that you've highlighted for us. Now, the person behind Pretty Woman, Fight Club,
yes.
LA Confidential, the producer, the Hollywood producer of that has just revealed that he was actually a spy. Tell us who it was.
It wasn't Spielberg, was it? It's an absolutely fantastic story. An Israeli Hollywood producer by the name of Arnon Milchan, who was the chairman of New Regency and, like you said, was behind Pretty Woman and Fight Club and some quite big Hollywood blockbusters, has revealed over the weekend to an Israeli investigative channel, a news program on Channel 2, that he was, in fact, an Israeli Mossad agent and an Israeli arms dealer. And he did this in a very kind of proud way. There was nothing that was kind of something to be dismissed in this interview. He basically came out and said that I was an Israeli, I was sent to the United States, and while in the United States, I was working to obtain technology for Israel's rumored nuclear program, as well as doing various kind of arms dealings while I was working as a Hollywood producer. Now, they even got Robert De Niro, who apparently is this guy's friend, to comment about his experience with this producer, and De Niro said to the Israeli program that, you know, he always always thought that there was something a little nefarious, a little bit kind of sketchy about this producer, but he just kind of chalked it up to his really strong nationalism of being an Israeli abroad.
Doesn't it kind of beg the question that, you know, how many more like him are out there?
It definitely does. I mean, we're kind of venturing into a bit of conspiratorial territory, but it is quite well known that there are a number of Israeli, very high-ranking Israeli, you know, kind of Hollywood producers and whatnot. And if we look at the success of Homeland, you know, this is an Israeli export. And so Israel does very much have a foothold in the United States. And one can only imagine that that the Mossad and other Israeli state institutions are using this foothold to their own benefit.
My big question is, how did this guy end up creating such a delicate film like Pretty Woman?
Delicate. Yeah. Delicate?
Romantic comedy. You know, that's very nice. Yeah. Joseph, thanks very much for joining us here on the program. Monocle's Joseph Dana speaking to us from Istanbul.
You're listening to Midori House. After this, we'll be finding out how drones could revolutionize the craft of journalism.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
You don't write a book lightly, and I didn't really want to write a book, so I had to find something which could only be explained in a book.
Take the Global Pulse.
Singapore is too small to have a known huge art scene to be competitive on a global level.
The old distinction between policy being made in London and executed by diplomats abroad has gone.
A lot of people come south for the opium harvest, and literally as soon as the last opium poppy is harvested, they will then take up arms and fight for a few weeks. It's purely practical.
And occasionally take things down a notch too.
I mean, if someone wants to buy it for $100 million, we would sell it.
Our radio station's got quite a wealthy demographic. I think you're in the right place.
To end the week with the best chat.
I've been confused for Kenny Loggins, actually.
I want to start with a very simple question. Why did we go to war with Iraq?
Some great music.
A grand piano is kind of a condescending icon at this point.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
And you're back with Midori House. The time is coming up to 8:42 here in London. Now, could drones be about to transform journalism? In the aftermath of Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines, some senior reporters have been filming and photographing the destruction using unmanned vehicles to transport their cameras. Instead of asking for a ride on military helicopters, taking space which of course is badly needed by rescue groups and supplies, they chose to launch their drones above the skies to capture images that they couldn't otherwise get.
Well, mainstream news organizations like CNN or the BBC have started using what they call unmanned aerial systems. Journalism schools at Columbia University and the University of Missouri have started teaching a class called drone journalism. So how does this new technology work? And does the use of drones raise new ethical issues for journalists? Well, a little earlier, Monocle producer Daphne Denis spoke with David Goldberg. He's co-author of a report on remotely piloted aircraft systems and journalism. A handful there, published by the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism.
How long has the use of drones been a thing in journalism?
Well, I think it's fairly recent, to be honest. I wouldn't put it as much more than a couple of years. I was first made aware of it by the work of a man called Matt Waite in Nebraska in the United States, who set up something called the Drone Journalism Laboratory. And it was really Matt that put me on to the notion that remotely piloted aircraft systems could in fact be used for journalism. And they have been off and on over the years, as I say, the last couple of years, but not only or perhaps even mainly by mainstream media. I think it's perhaps not uninteresting to point out that because we're speaking about very small aircraft, probably less than 20 kilograms, quite a number of the uses have been by what we may call, or what you might call, citizen journalists. For example, I was just made aware the other day, in fact yesterday, about the use of remotely piloted aircraft systems in Bangkok, monitoring the size of the crowd currently demonstrating in Bangkok. But these are not necessarily being used by mainstream media. They are open to, and in fact have and are being used by, citizen journalists as well.
So what are the specifics of this? Because obviously you say that citizen journalists can do this, but it's just difficult to imagine anybody having access to this kind of technology.
You're only talking about a few hundred dollars here, because we're not talking about what you're calling a drone, which can be as big and have a wingspan as big as a 737 jet aircraft. We're talking here about small aircraft which are less than 20 kilograms and can be bought off the shelf for a few hundred dollars. They have a short battery life and they need a fairly high degree of expertise to fly them, particularly if there's adverse weather conditions. But the reason why I'm emphasizing the fact that they are not only used by mainstream journalists is precisely because of their cheapness and accessibility. You can easily buy one off the net this afternoon, and if you're capable, fly it. I mean, that may not be, it may not mean that you can fly it legally. There are restrictions in all countries about the use of aircraft, particularly when they're being used for non-recreational purposes, as the use of journalism would be. But it is indeed their cheapness and their accessibility which is actually fueling their demand and the interest in using them.
So talking about the legal aspect here, obviously you were saying not everybody's allowed to fly them, regardless of whether they do or not. And obviously there's also some questions of privacy that should be raised with at least mainstream journalist organizations. You think that if you can just send an unmanned vehicle up in the air to take photographs or videos, that's going to be a big problem for the invasion of privacy of pretty much anybody?
No, it's absolutely no problem whatsoever. And, or put it more specifically, it's not a new problem or a problem related to the use of remotely piloted aircraft systems. If you're talking about the issue of privacy in relation to journalism, then the use of a remotely piloted aircraft is no different to the situation of using a long lens camera. So I have got no particular interest in the issue of privacy. It's not unique to remotely piloted aircraft and doesn't really raise any, in principle, doesn't raise any new legal concerns. The legality comes when you recognize and understand that these are aircraft by definition and therefore have to comply with aviation law and in the United Kingdom, the Civil Aviation Act and the Air Navigation Orders. And it's that which is the new legal dimension for the use of these vehicles and not the issue of privacy whatsoever.
I know that some schools have started teaching drone journalism, as they call it. Do you think that this is the future of news reporting?
No, I don't. I mean, these are flying cameras and therefore they are an adjunct, they are a tool. They will be useful in certain situations. Journalists are figuring out how and when to use them. The BBC, for example, has started using a hexacopter and is very sensitive to the kind of shots that can be taken by these and will only use them when they think it's going to give added value. So I don't see it as something which is going to take over in the sort of journalist toolbox, whether it be a citizen journalist or not. But I do see it as something which journalism and journalists will consider as to whether it might give some added value or indeed even a USP in relation to a particular situation.
And finally, what do you think has been the most interesting use of unmanned vehicles so far in journalism?
Well, I just think the fact that they are being used is what it is that is the most interesting. It's the fact that they have started to offer a unique perspective on scenarios and situations. You yourself mentioned the aftermath of Typhoon Hainan. You couldn't use it during the intensity of the storm because they're actually extremely vulnerable to, as any aircraft is, to very high winds. But the fact that they can offer a perspective on a situation which it could be dangerous for journalists, one of the interesting aspects of their use will be to facilitate using them in situations where it might be difficult or dangerous indeed for a journalist to venture into a particular area. So perhaps you might want to think about them in the context of health and safety at work.
David Goldberg there in conversation with Daphne Denis. He's the co-author of a report on remotely piloted aircraft systems and journalism, published by the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism.
And in a moment, we'll be reviewing the Nordic front pages with everyone's favorite Finn, Markus Hippie. But first, time for some music from the Northern Lands. This is Danish singer Mø with Glass. And that was Glass there by the Danish singer Mø.
Now you're listening to Midori House, Tadhg Enright and Phil Hahn, now joined by Markus Hippie.
Good morning.
Good morning. Who's here to review the Nordic papers with us?
You do love saying his name, Tadhg. Do you get very excited?
I hear you in the station promos, Markus.
Just
say your name for me.
Markus Hippie.
Oh, wow. There you go.
Can't beat that.
I know, it's that childlike thing when you learn a new word and Markus, you keep want to keep on repeating it.
I like the way different, you know, nations have different, you know, ways of different emphasis within words.
I know, and I think you must get that quite often as well. Yeah. You know, when I saw your name written first, I have no idea.
There's a subtlety to the pronunciation of Tadhg, because it should really be Tadhg. But I'll try that next time. Tadhg. With a very soft T, almost like you're saying TH, Tadhg.
Monocle 24 will never be the same again.
Never will. Let's talk about some newspapers and some stories.
So the first story is something we actually covered on Thursday last week in Helsinki when we did a special edition of the briefing from there. We spoke to one of the founders of Jolla, which is a mobile phone company manufacturer, a new one, mostly consisting of ex-Nokia staff. Well, is being quite deep downhill ride for Nokia in Finland, and obviously the mobile phone industry was actually sold away from the country to Microsoft as well. So these guys stayed in Finland and decided to come up with their own company, and they are actually releasing their first Jolla smartphone in Helsinki today.
What's the phone like? Give us a little preview.
There's a quick photo. It looks all right. It looks nice. It kind of reminds me of Nokia.
It looks very like that new Nokia phone.
Exactly. May not be a coincidence. The thing that makes it different is their operating system that's called Sailfish. And please don't ask any more technical... Sailfish. Please don't ask any more technical details. Anyway, it's new.
Sailfish.
And no one has really been using that before. So that's one of the things they're hoping will turn this product into a success. The other one is that it's coming to the domestic market in Finland now. There are no other domestic mobile phone manufacturers at the moment. So they're hoping to turn Jolla into a national pride.
Well, you were, of course, just in Helsinki for the Monocle Nordic Tour. Do you think that people in Finland would choose this phone just because it is Finnish?
I don't know. I really don't know. On the other hand, Finnish economy is doing so badly at the moment that I think that some people who kind of feel their responsibilities to support the Finnish economy could do that.
And they're going to need a lot more than just the Finnish market, even if they take off like a rip-roaring success
They're going to start in Finland, but they are planning to take over Europe before the end of this year.
Wow, so am I.
Watch the space.
And the
before
prices.
The end of this year.
They've only got about five weeks. I know. It has better be a massive success story.
Yeah.
Shall we move on to Sweden? There are two Swedish journalists missing in Syria. Details are sparse, but supposedly these two had been taken away to an unknown location on Saturday, and we haven't heard of these two journalists after that. The other one was a freelance journalist reporter, the other one was a photographer. Obviously, big news in Sweden. They don't face these kind of situations very often just because the foreign correspondent network, you know, journalists going abroad from Sweden or even Finland, there aren't that many of them. Another example of how dangerous Syria is becoming for foreign reporters. This actually may involve Finland as well. It was just reported in Finland today that the other journalist may have a dual citizenship because his grandparents were Finnish.
So, and do we know if they are working for the state broadcaster, the national newspaper?
Freelancers at the moment, but working on the paper side. So Dagens Nyheter is one of the papers that has been mentioned.
Indeed, they wouldn't be the first journalist to go missing in Syria.
No, not at all.
Sadly.
Not at all, sadly. I've got quite a few stories, so shall we move on?
Yes, let's.
Away. Let's continue with Finnish media landscape, a rocky ride. Finnish economy is very export-driven, and therefore it's also reflected on what's going on in the media. There's a lot of companies just sacking their staff. And the latest one is Suomen tietotoimisto, the Finnish Official Sorry, News Steven. Agency, that is going to later. It's quite a long word. They're going to get rid of a significant number of journalists. But there is a new idea, though, that has made some people quite excited.
Okay.
In Finland, as in many other Nordic countries, you have to pay quite a lot of extra money for having staff working overnight. They are considering of sending some of their staff to Australia.
Wow.
So they can work there during the day, but at the same time, it's night in Finland. How convenient is that?
I would take that opportunity, given half the chance.
Marcus, I hope we don't lose you to Australia.
I'm tempted. We love having you here.
And it's nearly Christmas, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
You got to give us a good reindeer story.
Well, if Finnish mobile phones are not going to take over the world, maybe reindeer will. The UN Food Agency has said that people should seriously consider starting using reindeer milk more, because when it comes to cow milk, it's quite expensive, and they're expecting that the prices could go down if other animals were used for this purpose as well, including reindeer.
That's quite interesting.
What's it like to milk a reindeer?
I haven't done it, believe it or not. Another story, also reindeer meat. Europe wants it. German industries were trying to order as many as 100,000 reindeers.
For some festive burgers or
exactly.
something,
unfortunately, unfortunately, Finland can't actually let any reindeer meat go abroad, because Finland is using it all itself.
Oh, greedy Finns.
Exactly. So,
what's reindeer taste like?
Have you not eaten it?
No. Maybe I have inadvertently.
I keep on bringing it to Midori House every second month.
Oh.
Bring
me some.
It reminds me of lamb.
Lamb?
Yeah.
That's nice. Good.
We like lamb.
If you are lucky, by the way, at least reindeer alive at Midori House courtyard.
I wouldn't like to eat a live
one. In a week
one,
or two.
And I couldn't eat a whole one either.
But when we have Santa Claus here with reindeer.
The Monocle Christmas Market.
As Monocle Christmas
Market.
I don't think
Santa would appreciate me tucking into his ride.
No, don't do that.
But at least reindeer alive here.
Thanks very much, Marcus, for joining us on the program. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today. Thanks to our producer, Daphne Denny, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Iona McLaren, and our studio manager, Bill Ludi. Up next, after the news, is The Menu with Marcus Hippie. Stay tuned for the briefing at midday in London, 7 a.m. in New York. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Ty Genwright, it's goodbye, and thank you very much for listening.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness. A witness to words that moved nations. Its dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time. It tells history. Rolex.